thanks for having me, Asaf, and it's a pleasure to be with your group. And hi to Alex as well out there. So Lebanon, you know, just this week it was announced that the United States State Department, the Biden administration, would reprogram about $70 million in funding, military funding for Lebanon that had originally been designated to purchase weapons for the Lebanese Armed Forces, bullets, uniforms, that kind of thing, that this money would be reprogrammed and given to the UN to hand out in stipends, about $100 a month per soldier in the Lebanese Armed Forces, and to the internal security forces. And that is essentially the police of Lebanon. And that was done because Lebanon is in the midst of a financial crisis, and we'll talk more about that later. And the Biden administration was worried about the stability of these alleged institutions, these the army and the police, for maintaining public order. This comes, and in fact, the U.S. ambassador, who I think quite highly of, Dorothy Shea, was at a ceremony, I think just 2 days ago, handing out the checks to the head of the internal security forces and the head of the army. This came almost a day after the head of the security forces announced that they would not implement the rulings of a Lebanese judge who had found or issued an indictment and had mandated the questioning of several Lebanese officials and former officials who were involved or needed to be brought in questioning and the investigation of the Beirut port blast. And you might remember that from a few years back, the largest atomic explosion, I think, or explosion measured since Hiroshima, I think, that happened in Beirut port that killed over 200. And so the United States government is essentially giving $70 million to, among other people in Lebanon, people who are obstructing the justice into the port blast that killed so many in Lebanon and devastated the city. This is, I think, really indicative in many ways of U.S. policy on Lebanon. There is a view that we have to help Lebanon. I think that's a unanimous view, largely. We should do something to help Lebanon, notwithstanding the fact that Lebanon is not helping itself. At the same time that Lebanon is largely dominated by Hezbollah, the Iranian-backed terrorist organization that Iran established in the early 1980s in Lebanon. So there is a real, I think, disconnect in many ways about our policy. So why are the Lebanese Armed Forces and the ISF in need of this $70 million? Well, even before the port disaster, before the port explosion, and by the way, the port exploded because it was filled with ammonium nitrate, which basically is a fertilizer, but also used to make explosives. And there were tons of it being stored unsafely at the port. It was not an intentional explosion, but it was, I think, by negligence that all this explosive material was being stored at the port since 2014. In the heart of Beirut. So why do they need all this money? They need this money because the state is amidst an enormous financial crisis. This crisis didn't start with the port explosion, although the port explosion and And COVID certainly exacerbated the situation. This was a financial crisis that was years in the making. The fundamentals of Lebanon's economy are incredibly problematic, but in the aftermath of the civil war, which lasted from 1975 to 1991, give or take, Lebanon took a great deal of loans to rebuild the country. They continued to build loans. The banks have shady practices. There's no financial transparency. They have great banking secrecy laws, a lot of money laundering going on. And banking became an enormous sector in Lebanon. But one of the practices among many that the central bank did was to borrow money from local banks that it would repay sometimes at high levels of interest, which obviously over time is problematic. Likewise, there was a peg to the dollar of the Lebanese lira. And in order to encourage people to hold Lebanese lira, the central bank would pay something like, banks would pay something like 16, 15, 10, depending on the time, percent interest on lira deposits. So people kept their lira deposits, got this great interest, and no money was loaned out for economic development, et cetera. Anyway, long story. The country was basically built on an economic Ponzi scheme. And ultimately, we faced a collapse where the central bank could no longer print sufficient money and to guarantee or pay interest. And there was a run on the banks, and you had financial collapse. And the value of the Lebanese lira used to be $1,500 to a dollar. You could get into a taxi in Beirut and say, hey, I'm going from here to there. And you could pay with a $20 bill and get change in Lebanese lira, and you knew exactly how much you were going to get because of the peg. It turned out over time that the currency was devalued, right? It became less and less worth anything. You couldn't get money out of the bank. Your deposits were not accessible. And the currency devaluated first to something like, over time, it's now well over 30, 40, 50,000 lira to a dollar. And so it's lost more than 90, 95% of its value. People's life savings have been wiped out. And if you're being paid by the government, as if you're in the army or the police, what was equivalent to $500 monthly salary became, tens, twenties of dollars a month, just insufficient. People weren't showing up to work. You now have something like 80, 85% of Lebanese below the poverty line. You've had 600,000, 700,000, 800,000 out of nearly 5 million Lebanese flee the country, go to Europe or anywhere else in the region where they could get out. This is going to have obviously long-term consequences for Lebanon. So you've had this enormous deterioration in the economy. And this, I think, has worried consecutive U.S. government. So when I worked in the State Department, we backed a World Bank social safety net program. The United States provides something like 17% of World Bank funding. And so we underwrote a large program for the Lebanese people. We stopped giving money to other than military funding to the Lebanese government, because we found that the government of Lebanon was no longer responsible. And by the way, as this whole deterioration was happening over a period of like 3-4 years until now, the United States got together with France and other states and talked about an IMF program for Lebanon. But because the economy is so warped, because there are subsidies for electricity, for energy, et cetera, gasoline, oil, the condition of the IMF program to help them get out of this crisis was that the government would implement reforms. You had a government back then. The government has since collapsed. They have a new government that is a caretaker government. You have a parliament that is broken. You have a vacuum in the office of the president. There hasn't been a president for a few months, but that's a sort of normal state of affairs for Lebanon. But decisions can't be made, and the government of Lebanon, such as it is, hasn't been able to enter into an IMF program. But in any event, the country, if you can call it a country, is basically a failing state with something like $80 or $90 billion in debt on what used to be a $40 billion economy. It's now down to like $20 billion a year, maybe less. This is an extremely challenging situation. There's a lot of suffering going on. And amidst all this, of course, is the fact that the state is dominated in large part by Hezbollah. Rough breakdown of the population is maybe 28% Christian. People are, by the way, counted as citizens, even if they're living abroad and have full-time dual nationality, et cetera. There's many Lebanese living abroad, many of them being Christian. Maybe 28-30% Christian, maybe 34%, I don't know the numbers here, 34% Maronite Christian, a small number of Druze, and a plurality, maybe 35-36%, maybe 37% Shiite Muslim. And the vast majority of those Shiites are represented by Hezbollah, which both dominates the community, provides patronage to the community, protects the community, and intimidates the rest of the Lebanese population because they're the only real militia in the country that, since the civil war, has kept its weapons. Sometimes those weapons are pointed toward Israel. They're oftentimes pointed toward the people of Lebanon as well. So these are, Lebanese people are in many ways a captive population. So Hezbollah dominates, they're backed by Iran, and they call themselves Al-Muqawama Islamiya fi Lebanon, the Islamic resistance in Lebanon. Their mission is not only to, long-term is the destruction of Israel, the quote-unquote liberation of Jerusalem, but also in the short-term to resist against Israel. But Hezbollah is basically a regional militia of Iran. It operated in Syria during the civil war. It's operated in Yemen to train the Iranian-backed Houthi militia. There are reports that it also has shown up in Iraq to aid other Iranian-backed militia there. So it's really a regional militia that's operating out of Lebanon. And there's a big question for the United States government, a debate. And this periodically resurfaces, is Lebanon Hezbollah? So there are many outside the government who say, well, it is Hezbollah. There's nothing we can do to dislodge this group, and we should treat all of Lebanon as if it was Hezbollah. And the United States government, in military and then economic support, gives something like $230 million a year to Lebanon. It's not insufficient, but the opposite side of the argument is, we're buying some influence with Lebanon. We are Lebanon would be more dependent on Iran, more in the hands of Iran. Maybe China and Russia would have some influence in Lebanon if the United States wasn't there. At least we have influence within the Lebanese armed forces. These are topics of debate. One thing's for sure is the Lebanese armed forces, no matter how much the United States funds this organization, will ever take on challenge, obstruct Hezbollah. The last time something like that happened was essentially, during the Civil War, in the very early days of the Civil War, when the Lebanese military took on one particular sectarian group and then split along sectarian lines of Lebanese armed forces made up of Christian Sunni Shia and Druze, and the military just broke down. So, and this is not sort of within the realm of possible, nor is that something that is ultimately a goal of the U.S. funding for the Lebanese armed forces. Complicating matters, the UN has stationed in South Lebanon its largest peacekeeping force, known as UNIFIL, UN Interim Force in Lebanon. It has been present there since 1982, if not before. Some people say 1978, when it was sent there to keep the peace between Israel and the PLO, which was located in South Lebanon after they were kicked out of Jordan in 1975. This organization at the time was something like 2,000 troops. It has grown to over 10,000 troops, with more peacekeepers per kilometer than any other site in the world. And these people are there, among other things, to prevent Hezbollah from building up its militia in the aftermath of the 2006 war between Israel and Hezbollah, to prevent the organization from rebuilding and rearming. The organization cannot carry out its mission. It hasn't carried out its mission, and it's oftentimes targeted, attacked, intimidated by Hezbollah. At the same time, the organization spends a great deal of money in the South, basically amidst Hezbollah's constituents, fueling the local economy for Hezbollah's constituents. So it's an odd situation, and every time there is a conflagration between Israel and Hezbollah, invariably some of these peacekeepers end up getting killed. They are human shields for Hezbollah. So this is one issue going on. You might have also read about the U.S. brokering a maritime border agreement between Israel and Lebanon, the first of its kind. The Biden administration did that. When I was serving in the Trump administration, we actually opened up these talks, which had been frozen for about a decade. But Amos Hochstein brought over the finish line, and they have delineated a maritime border between Israel and Lebanon. The terms of the agreement were favorable to Lebanon, but I think Israel was very pleased to have any type of agreement in which Lebanon, which although it didn't sign an agreement directly with Israel, but rather with the United States, and filed an agreement with the UN rather than signing an agreement like the Abraham Accords with Israel, that Israel actually got out of this, that Lebanon for the first time recognized in a way the existence, if not the right, of Israel to exist. So the government led by Lapid signed off on this deal with the Biden administration. There's a lot of arguments about whether this is a good thing or a bad thing. On the one hand, there's no such thing as a sovereign wealth agreement or sovereign wealth fund in Lebanon. And so that means that like Israel, Lebanon likely has offshore gas. And if any of that is developed, and some of it, the Total and the Italian firm Eni, as well as a Qatari firm, have a partnership to develop a promising natural gas field. If any profits are made without a sovereign wealth fund, Lebanon being one of the most corrupt countries in the world, would this money benefit the Lebanese people who are suffering so much? Or would it just benefit not only corrupt politicians, but a corrupt politicians, among them Hezbollah? The Israeli officials likewise said in the aftermath of this agreement that Israel was safer. And I think this is totally unproven. Certainly, I think there were some benefits of the agreement. Hezbollah obviously signed off on this agreement. So what I like to say is that Hezbollah has now become business partners with the state of Israel. They don't like to hear that. And it has, in a way, discredited them in Lebanon. But this organization still remains the strongest. And there's no signs at all that things are becoming more quiet now or more stable along what's known as the blue line. That is the frontier between Israel and Lebanon, the land border, where we're seeing quite a bit of escalation in recent months and years. Hezbollah is building what are known as the Green Without Borders, environmental NGO sites. These are essentially military bases along the border with Israel that UNIFIL, the peacekeepers, are not allowed to enter because they are so-called private property. So there's increasingly territory in the south that UNIFIL cannot observe or monitor. In any event, even if they did monitor it, they wouldn't find or take any weapons from Hezbollah. That's a no-no. That's beyond the purview of the organization. Back to where the key point here, is Lebanon Hezbollah? I must say, I spent a lot of time in Lebanon, especially before I was in government. It's a little bit more challenging for me to go back now. Designated a lot of Lebanese for terrorism and corruption when I was in the government. Most Lebanese are not fans of Hezbollah. My belief is that they are captives of Hezbollah. And when you stand up to Hezbollah, they operate like any terrorist organization worth their weight would do. They either intimidate you or they kill you. And I know plenty of Lebanese, some of whom were my friends who have been killed by Hezbollah. There is no accountability in the country, so it's a dangerous thing to stand up to Hezbollah. You're declared a traitor. There are laws in Lebanon where you can be prosecuted by the military, among others, either for normalizing with Israel, quote unquote, normalizing with Israel, or critiquing, in a way, Hezbollah. And once again, the LAF, the Lebanese Armed Forces organization that we fund, we are the single largest funder of this organization. But this is still the dominant organization in the country. The financial crisis is hurting Hezbollah's constituents as well. It doesn't have the money it used to have. The maximum pressure campaign that the Trump administration implemented against Iran hurt Hezbollah, but the organization is still standing. It is proved resilient, and when it couldn't get all its money from Iran directly, it went into narco trafficking. It is now a big trafficker and producer of what's known as Captagon, which is an amphetamine that is a drug of choice of groups like ISIS. But others throughout the region. This is a Syrian business, but Hezbollah is essentially the business partner of the Assad regime and the production and distribution of this drug throughout the region. So mixed bag here. You have a country that I always saw and still see as a battleground for the United States and Iran in the region. Much like Iraq, if you leave Iraq, Iran will dominate. Iran is already dominating to a certain extent. They planted a militia in Iraq that has 110,000 armed people and gets paid by the government of Iraq. But we are present. We have influence. And we decided, notwithstanding threats to Americans, troops, diplomats, etc., that we weren't going to leave Iraq. And I think there is a good reason to be in Lebanon if we have people who are like-minded to contest the space. But it's quite challenging, and I think it's a generational project. And so with that, I think I've spoken more than enough. Happy to take any and all of the questions. Thank you. Great.
Thank you so much for that, David. There's obviously a lot to talk about, and thank you for unpacking what is this ongoing tapestry of Lebanon that we've been looking at for so many years. I'm going to let Alex start us off with the first question, and then obviously we are opening up the floor to as many questions as we have. So if you have questions, feel free to type them in into the chat. And Alex, why don't you start us off?
Sure. Well, thanks. Thanks very much for a comprehensive, if rather depressing, overview of where we're at. As you were talking, I was very much struck that UNIFIL was introduced into southern Lebanon decades ago as a on the theory first that it could somehow prevent conflict and between Israel and Lebanon, really Hezbollah, and then it became this kind of tripwire notion. And I'm wondering whether the gas situation is proceeding along the same kind of theory, that certainly when the agreement was being discussed and on the verge of being approved within Israel, the argument, one of the arguments, was that this gives Lebanon something to lose. Yeah. And but I'm wondering, is that really the case? And is it really a situation where, once again, the U.S. has somehow made itself a hostage in this kind of larger equation by guaranteeing all sides or trying to make all sides profit when one side seems to very much ascribe to a zero-sum mentality? More of a series of impressions than a question, but I'll let you have
it. No, I think it's the right question, Alex. So I was a little, mystified when, Amos Hawksing is a very smart guy and obviously, a very talented negotiator to be able to, he's the energy envoy for the Biden administration at the State Department. And, he was able to get both sides. Obviously there was a desire on both sides to come to some agreement. So, there had to be a delineation so that, this Lebanon had all these blocks. It's got 10, 11 blocks that it has divided all its maritime waters, this economic zone into. And, three of the most promising ones are on, had undefined borders because they were closest to Israel, and so they want. And one of those had already been bought up, had been contracted to Total, which is the French mega energy company, the stars aligned. But I was mystified that both the U.S. government and the Israeli government felt compelled to sell this agreement in terms of the benefits, in terms of the stabilizing impact that it would have on the region, stabilizing in terms of the border between Lebanon and Israel, stabilizing for energy extraction in the Mediterranean of offshore gas. Because I just didn't see it, but the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, said it as well as Lapid and everybody in the government at the time. And I just didn't see it. And so you asked the right question. The argument was this gives Lebanon something to lose, right? And so you're going to have an offshore rig, or a natural gas platform, that is owned by Total and partially owned by the Italian gas giant Eni, with Qatar there too now, with some element of investment. But it's basically going to be a Total platform. So do we think, and by the way, that Israel has said that basically, its number one challenge is strategic challenge of Iranian nukes, right? Its number two challenge, as it points out, is Hezbollah developing what they call precision guided munition project, which is upgrading all their 150,000 dumb rockets into guided munitions that will be accurate to within 5 meters that can hit any point in Israel. And the Israelis define that as a red line. And Hezbollah is proceeding with that project. And sooner or later, we're going to have another conflict. I think it's inevitable. It's regrettable, and there will be a lot of suffering, but it's inevitable that there will be another war between Israel and Lebanon. Now, do we think that Hezbollah will somehow, the Chevron, the U.S.-owned Chevron natural gas platform that is going to be in Karish or in Leviathan, that these platforms will somehow be off limits to Hezbollah during the next conflagration, that Israel will be able to extract natural gas and profit from it with impunity during the next war? I don't think Hezbollah is, at all going to be, dissuaded or somehow prevented from targeting this American asset. What do they care, right? They've launched wars against Israel. The last war that they launched against Israel cost $6 billion in damage in Lebanon. Zero cares from Hezbollah, right? And in return, right, like they say that Lebanon has something to lose. Do we think that Israel, if Hezbollah attacked a Chevron gas platform, right, or a rig that's going to be sitting in what's known as Karish Field, do we think that Israel will attack a Total platform that's sitting in Lebanese territorial waters, basically attacking an arm of the French government? I don't think it's the same thing. I think there's a lot higher cost for Israel attacking the French conglomerate than for Hezbollah attacking Chevron. So, I don't think this stabilizes in any way or insulates the maritime arena from conflict. And I am certain that, there is an inevitability about another conflict between Israel and Hezbollah. It's just a matter of time.
Great. Thank you. Alex, a follow-up before I go to the audience?
No, let's take some other questions. I have lots of other observations, but let's get more people involved.
Yeah, we'll come back to you, Alex. Okay, David, so James is asking a few questions, and let me try to consolidate them into one. So he's pointing out, he's observing that if Lebanon is indeed run by Iran, what is the downside to having U.S. policy wash its hands anything to do with Lebanon? And secondly, if UNIFIL is really so ineffective, then what's the need to maintain it? And obviously, that's something you touched on in the tablet article. But of course, if you haven't read the tablet article, obviously worthwhile reading this after David's webinar. But I'll turn it over to you, David.
Yeah. So I cover the UNIFIL thing pretty completely. I don't think there's a reason why UNIFIL should have 10,500 troops with a cap of 13,000 in South Lebanon. It's not doing the job. It doesn't have the access to the territory. And it costs $500 million to the UN per year, $125 million of which is U.S. dollars. There's no reason for it. And before the 2006 war, we had 2,000 troops there. And I think even maybe that's too much. But that would be a lot more reasonable than the 10,500 or so that we have right now. This was, after all, the UN quote-unquote interim force in Lebanon. Interim in terms of the United Nations, 40 years. This is a self-licking ice cream cone that grows bigger. UN bureaucracy protects itself. These organizations never get smaller. They tend to only get bigger. They go in one direction. But I don't think we should be maintaining it at this point. It's dangerous for the people that are operating there. They'll come into even more harm's way if there's another war. It'll be difficult to get them out. And Hezbollah has basically declared open season on UNIFIL. Well, they killed a few months ago in December, a UN peacekeeper was killed, but they're not infrequently targeted and harassed. The other question, should the U.S. wash its hands of Israel? It depends who you ask. You know, there are scholars out there, a guy at Foundation for Defense of Democracies, a guy named Tony Badran, a friend of mine, who says, yeah, we should get out of there. We shouldn't be there. You know, I disagree, right? As I said earlier, I think, you know, even though, you know, we are at a disadvantage in the region, right? We bring a lot of good things, right? If the United States is in your country, we can have free trade agreements. We do humanitarian assistance. Chinese don't do that. The Russians don't do that. When we are present, there's foreign direct investment. We have relationships with militaries where we don't sell them crap equipment. We sell them good equipment and do follow-on agreements with them. We build capacity. These are all, you know, benefits of having a relationship with the United States. But for certain countries, these aren't necessarily appealing. You know, for countries that are dominated by Iran, they want to see us out so they can take over entirely these countries. Now, some people would say, well, maybe Lebanon is entirely a satrapy of Iran. I'd say that, you know, you're giving up on a certain, you know, percentage of this population. Maybe they will push back someday. Maybe we should maintain a certain level of involvement. If we leave, I mean, we stop doing any humanitarian work. We let these people suffer humanitarianly. We let the Christian community of Lebanon that many people in the United States care about, we let that basically end, like much of it did has done in Iraq. I think that there are reasons why we'd want to say the argument used to be that you know, this was a model, if tenuous. A tenuous model of democracy in the region. I think, you know, certainly a model of broken democracy, but I think there's a reason to be there. And what we're spending there, although it should be less, is quite modest compared to what we get, the type of insight we get, the type of understanding, and some would argue the kind of influence we might have within the LAF, and that the situation would be a lot worse. Plus, you should know that Israel wants the United States to fund the LAF, the Lebanese Armed Forces. They want the United States to be involved. They don't want a total deterioration. There's the opposite view is that, well, if the state and people, it's collapsing, right? It's a failing state. It's not quite failed. You know, the state is not providing services, et cetera. But if it was totally a failed state, some would argue that, well, maybe Hezbollah would have to fight ISIS and they would be busy with fighting Sunni extremists in the country. I think it's a pretty cynical view. I don't want to see an emergence of ISIS or Sunni extremism either on Lebanon. It's not, Sunni extremism isn't any worse than the type of Shiite extremism like Hezbollah that we see. You know, there could be spillover effects on Israel. I don't think Israel liked the civil war in Syria either. So anyway, I sort of said enough on this. There's downsides to leaving, certainly.
Great, thank you for that. Carrie is asking a question. With all the high intention on the frontier, you know, what about Israel's recent opening of the Gahar, you know, into Israeli tourists as far as the Alawite village on the border? You know, is that something that, you know, I guess I'm adding to it. Is that, you know, recommended, not recommended, you know, as far as, is that a risk as far as maybe adding to kidnapping of Israelis, something we've seen on the Israeli border in the past and things of the like?
Well, I'm pretty sure that I've been to Qajar. It's an amazing thing to see. You know, just a line on a road that you're crossing into Israeli territory or territory that's under the, you know, authority of Israel. You know, it's a pretty remarkable place. I think I went over from the Lebanese side actually years ago. The Israeli government, I have you know, notwithstanding my critique of the IDF saying that the maritime border would make Israel safer, you know, I have confidence in the government of Israel and in the IDF that they wouldn't be letting tourists go into Qajar. If they believe that there was a, you know, some type of threat that there were, that they didn't have, sufficient security. I think, the view right now, I think by and large, is that, Hezbollah basically, threatened Israel into getting the maritime agreement. They said if Israel starts extracting gas from Karish Field before there's an agreement, then Hezbollah would attack the rig offshore. And Israel said, no, we're not going to be cowed by Hezbollah. We're going to extract gas as soon as the rig gets there in September. And Israel waited till November, right? Till after the deal was signed to start extracting gas. They actually didn't extract gas based on the threat from Hezbollah. I think, this was an escalation potentially, a deliberate escalation by Hezbollah and could have backfired for Hezbollah. But I think Israel understands that Hezbollah may push the limits along the blue line, along the border, but that even if they sort of push the limits, they still don't want to have a war with Israel and an attempted kidnapping, an attack on IDF along the border, I think, is something that could have unpredicted or predictable at this point results for Nasrallah and for Hezbollah. So I think, we're not there yet. So if you're making plans to go, now might be a good time. It might not be a great time in 6 months. Who knows?
So, but I mean, again, this on a general point, and let me add there, as far as, places like Hajar, is that helping, obviously with the normalization as far as trying to focus on, Israeli-Lebanese relations getting, is that from a cultural standpoint, is that something useful? Or still risky?
Yeah, I think, if there is engagement, from a certain side, or depending what this is not like a normalization agreement, right? I mean, I think many Israelis hoped that the maritime would be like a normalization agreement. It's not, right? It's an economic agreement. There's still anti-normalization laws in Lebanon. People are arrested, they're intimidated, they're threatened if they engage with Israelis. And so, if they're in the Israeli part of Hajar, whether this is something that, there's engagement with tourists. I mean, people want to do business. They want to have people go to their restaurants. I like that, that'd be fine, but I wouldn't make more of this than it is, right? Mm-hmm. They drew a line through the Med that was 100% of what Lebanon asked for when I started the negotiations with them. In return, you have, an end of claims for the time being, right? It's not in perpetuity. There's still one area that can be redressed, eventually. But, this is just so that resources can be exploited. And I think the administration wanted that so that there would potentially be more energy in the environment of Ukraine, more gas going to Europe, filling the gap for Russian energy, which isn't going to return anytime soon. But the first molecule of Lebanese gas won't show up for another 7 or 9 years.
Great, great. So going on to another question by our friend and colleague Chuck Feingold. He's asking about Syria, and really, where is Hezbollah these days when it comes to, their actions in Syria? Have they been permanently deterred? Is Chuck's point question, or is it, what else, and you can obviously go into the whole segue as far as your point about Russia now. How does all that fit into the whole equation?
Well, I don't know, Chuck. I don't know if I got this right here, but. We're asking about who being deterred.
Hezbollah being permanently deterred and acting in Syria.
No, they're not. They're not deterred whatsoever. Israel is going out every day and hitting targets in Syria. Some of these are periodically Damascus Airport, hitting shipments that come in. Some of them are out at the border at Qiyam, or you know, near Tanna, where there are containers that are coming across the border from Iraq via Syria, via Iran, that are this precision guided munitions, you know, upgrade kits or longer range missiles or things like this, destined for Hezbollah, that somebody, likely Israel, is hitting in Syria, also out at the Iraq border. But these things happen still every day. You know, traditionally, Israel hasn't tried to kill Iranian officers in Syria or Hezbollah officers. It does it periodically. You know, there are certain rules of the game that you can, you know, do attacks in Syria. But I don't remember, I don't recall the last time Israel did anything in Lebanon. I think we're talking about 5-6 years ago, maybe 4 years ago. It's a pretty infrequent thing, you know, if that, and they don't take, nobody's taking responsibility for it. But no, I don't think there's any deterrence. I think the Assad regime isn't going to tangle with Israel. They understand the score here, but no, Hezbollah is not deterred. And if you look at the reports, you know, that are coming out of Washington, Iran and its proxies, the IRGC, others, are doing more and more operational planning, attempted kidnappings, snatchings, killings, of targeting of Americans and Israelis abroad, right? Most recently, this plot that was foiled in Turkey to kill Israeli tourists. You know, I don't think there's any deterrence here yet.
Great. Thank you. I mean, obviously, you know, Hezbollah, you know, it's always been, you know, the playground back and forth there. So everybody sees it as a Wild West there, not deterred one way or another.
Yeah, the regime, the Assad regime, is deterred, right? It can't tangle with Israel, but it's still letting its airports be used to bring in advanced munitions for Hezbollah.
Agreed. Thank you for that. Alex, back to you.
Sure. I mean, the thing that strikes me is something that you and I have actually spoken about before, and that our friend Tony Badran speaks about frequently. Is there a Lebanon? If we agree, and I think your presentation has made it pretty clear that the Lebanese state is, if not completely coeval with Hezbollah, then at least dominated by Hezbollah, and Hezbollah is dominated by the IRGC, then is there a thing called Lebanon? Is it a place? Is it a kind of nominal nation state, or is this an ideal that people from the outside project onto it in a kind of naive or sentimental fashion? But the implications of this are very particular for American foreign policy. Hezbollah is Lebanon, or it's most of Lebanon. I don't know what.
Well, it's certainly a lot. Certainly
it's
a lot.
Yeah. 60%, 80%. So are we not, we, the United States, are we not engaged in material support for terrorism? Adversaries that are dedicated to our own downfall or that of our allies. And, you know, it's just this peculiar situation that we seem to have gotten ourselves into, where again, we make ourselves a kind of hostage.
Yeah. Listen, that itself is a couple hour discussion, right? We got to sit down and have a scotch and kick this back and forth. Certainly problematic.
A bottle of scotch, please. Whole bottle is necessary.
Yeah, certainly problematic that, you know, say the very least, that we, you know, we fund the LAF. And the LAF, which is obligated by the UN to give access, provide access and provide security for UNIFIL, isn't playing that role, right? Could it play that role? Was it unrealistic to expect that it could? Well, if it's not playing that role, then, you know, shouldn't the U.S. be, in a way, holding the LAF to a standard? Like, if the units that are supposed to be protecting UNIFIL or providing them access, if those units aren't doing that, then maybe we shouldn't be paying those units, right? I mean, there's ways that you can deal with that. But I think the question's right. You know, is Lebanon's an idea, right? I think it's an idea that has been, you know, over time glorified, or sort of, it's gotten a special sort of mythical status, I think, for many in the United States. This was, Lebanon was like the Paris of the Middle East. It was a democracy, a flawed democracy, sectarian democracy, but, you know, they had votes and the elections mattered. They had a parliament that was vibrant. They had civil society. They had all those things, and they still have all those things, and increasingly less of those things. And so I don't think we're complicit, right, by funding them. I mean, the thing about the choice, if you say we're getting out, right? Well, you know, this is a policy decision, right? And then what are the consequences of that, right? So we got out of Afghanistan. You could say, well, maybe it was, you know, an unwinnable war. We spent blood and treasure there. You know, we just couldn't win. Okay, the consequences. Like, one consequence is that, you know, 50% of the people who live in that country are now fifth-class citizens, right? You know, they can't work. They can't get educated. You know, I'm talking about women. You know, there's a consequence. Another consequence is that China is moving in and going to take all the rare earth that Afghanistan had. Now, maybe we weren't taking it anyway before, but certainly they're unimpeded. And that means they're going to have a leg up on cell phones and all the future, you know, economy, et cetera. Yeah, there's a cost for doing this. We're out, right? We're still paying humanitarian stuff, et cetera. But so what are we going to do in Lebanon? Well, Israel wants us there, right? We want to engage. And could things ever be turned around? Well, I could very, very easily imagine a situation in the future. What would happen if this clerical regime in Tehran, if something would befall the regime, right? You know, we had some very serious protests there. I'm not saying that there's anything imminent. They seem to be stalled, but what if there was a changer? Wouldn't we want to be in Lebanon if Hezbollah wasn't getting any support from Iran anymore? I don't know, but there's, you know, there's consequences to every decision. So I'm not ready to write it off, but neither do I. I think we should hold the people that we give money to a high standard. I think we should think about what is the right presence there. And I think about, we shouldn't be under any illusions as to what's happening there either.
Great. Alex, follow up, or you're good?
Well, I agree. And I would clarify that my own, you know, I don't have an answer to this conundrum, obviously, but it's a very, very old one that goes back to the very beginning of the Cold War, if not to the, let's say, the Monroe Doctrine itself, that you have to deal with the situations that you find on the ground, and the you know, the other countries are not in your control, but things can go further and further out of your control. But the point you make about Iran, I think, is a critical one. That here's the patron, and U.S. policy with respect to Iran is intimately tied to that of Lebanon, as well as other countries in the region. And I guess my final question would be, are these policy tracks considered in unison within the U.S. government, or are they separate and unconnected?
You know, I think that varies by administration. I know that, you know, when I worked in the Bush administration, I worked in the Trump administration for Pompeo, you know, Iraq and Lebanon, we thought of, you know, not only as, you know, important countries, but also countries that were, you know, arenas of competition with Iran and other regional trends. And it was important to, you know, to be present in those areas. The case of Iraq, to keep it between the sort of 40-yard lines, you know. We have very different, you know, we're at a distinct disadvantage in many ways in the region. Like I said earlier, we have a lot of things that we can bring to these relationships, but, you know, we are also 6,000 miles away. And, you know, if the United States doesn't like what you're doing in a particular country, we may designate you under the Magnitsky Act or for terrorism. If the Iranians don't like what you're doing, they kill you. I'm not saying the United States should behave that way. The fact that I think we absolutely should not. But, you know, this has inherent advantages for Iran in its ground game. And so I think we gotta be present. I think we definitely saw it as a related, our Iran policy, our policies in many of these countries in the region that are, you know, being attacked either directly or indirectly by Iranian proxies. We saw the relationship. I think the Biden administration, you know, has that too, but to a lesser degree. I think early on you saw there were people who were killed by Iranian proxies. One of my best friends in Lebanon, a guy named Lokman Sleen, was murdered by basically Hezbollah 3 weeks after we left government, after the Pompeo and I left the State Department. And we got a statement out of the State Department. We didn't see any sanctions, no major policy initiative to, you know, basically hold those accountable for the killing of an American grant recipient. To a more or lesser degree, I think, you know, this administration, you know, led up initially on these questions of, you know, implementing sanctions against Iran, going after the allies, lifting the sanction against the Houthi, the terrorist designation early on, because it saw it as related, but in a different way, which is we have to ease up pressure so that we can get to an agreement to get back into the JCPOA with Iran. They too see it as connected, but in a different kind of way than we saw it in the previous administration.
Great. David, I want to thank you for everything. I mean, you've unpacked a lot of the complexities and obviously an ongoing fluid situation. So I do look forward to bringing that case of scotch at this point to continue and try to go back and forth on everything else. But really, I want to thank you. I want to thank Alex, as always, for joining me this afternoon. And above all, I want to thank the audience, as always, for joining us on our conversations. Please be on the lookout for future conversations. David, I hope you can come back and join us again at a later date as things evolve. And we will definitely continue all of these conversations. So thank you, everybody, and have a good day.
Great talking to you.